Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. To those of you checking this out for the first time, I said thank you for your time, energy, and willingness to sit down. So this is a pretty sweet podcast that took me two separate times to get down and recorded. Today's podcast, I have the honor, really the privilege, if you know anything about who this is and the space, but it's Dennis Boyle. He's the co-founder of IDEO. IDEO is really the forefather of design thinking. They are a guru in the space of product concept, brand concept. I mean, they're just a phenomenal company out of the San Jose area. And Dennis couldn't be more sweet and kind and generous with his time, especially for a man that is, you know, one of many partners, but, you know, running a business that I think it's across 9 countries, 700 employees. So, you know, he's just so nice. Just, he like oozes niceness. So enjoy that podcast. Also remember that I am part of the C-Suite Network, Thrive Global. Ariana Huffington is now my new content partner. Engage Me Online Magazine, as well as Conscious Business Radio. So everyone have a nice week. Leave a review, and I'm recording a sweet interview right now. See you. So, you know, we were talking a second ago about this idea of you always being super healthy, super focused on staying active. Is that something that you did as a child that you just kind of took on?
I just think because it's fun. It's interesting. It just seems like the right thing to do. And I do it quite socially. Almost everything I do with other people, or friends, or relatives, or you know, teammates, or something. When we were kids, as the oldest of 7 children, we lived in Midland, Michigan. We were outdoors playing a lot. We were outside a lot. I built these little mini bikes and go-karts, and sort of got me going in the whole direction of being a design engineer kind of thing early on. But I started in grade school, I really wanted to play basketball. I loved basketball, and I wasn't very good, but I did try as hard as I could, and well, at least I got got in some games and so on. But I kind of learned that I could run. You know, I think I started playing tennis too, because my parents got tennis lessons, and we were sailing. We had a cool little cabin or cottage on a lake, and we had little sailboats, and I made sailboats with my brothers, and we fished and sailed, and we did stuff out and swam.
So it just sounds like your whole life was active. Like everything you did was just active.
Yeah, we played touch football on the beach every night for decades.
So of the 7 of you, though, how many are boys, how many are girls?
There's 5 boys and 2 girls.
And are the girls later, earlier? Because that would probably play into the competitive nature of your house.
Well, there's 3 boys, 2 girls, 2 boys kind of thing.
Wow.
Which was, you know, in hindsight, kind of a nice way to do it, because the 3 boys, well, everybody's pretty close. We all live within a few miles of each other out here in California now, oddly enough. but we're a very close family. My one brother works with me, and I see my other brothers and sisters on a weekly basis.
So what made them all move out there?
Well, it's a long story. I got into Stanford and started kind of a – people started visiting me and my
Was this around like 1977?
Yeah, 75. Yeah, 75.
75.
And my oldest – you know, I was here for – with some time out to work in Detroit automotive scene. But I was here for – 5, 6, 7 years, and one of my sisters is a nurse and got an offer to, they had a nursing shortage at Stanford Hospital, and she came out in like 82 and started that because I was here and kind of gave her a little beachhead. I've been at IDEO ever since. We're kind of long distance people or and have a lot of endurance in our family. So
where does that come from?
You know, I don't know. I think our parents were, they were committed. They didn't move around that much. They were committed to each other. They were kind of committed to their careers. In the case of my father, my mother committed to his family like crazy and just never gave up, committed to her dogs.
What did your dad do?
He was an architect.
It sounds like, you know, with your mom and dad, obviously your mom's committed to a family, big family. My guess is it's a big Midwest Catholic family,
as you would probably do
in Michigan. And your dad's his architect, which is a skill set that is about detail and exactness, right? And
well,
it would seem
would
that no,
no. I wouldn't start leave with that. I would say it's about the look and feel from the outside, and the look and the feel from the inside. So I think that kind of got passed on to all of us, especially the kind of the ability to make things or the ability to see the way things were made, or there's appreciation of the way things look, large and small. I think that got passed on to all of us, and certainly for me, and four of the five boys are engineers, so we kind of picked up some of that. He encouraged that by having a little shop around and making lots of stuff with us.
So going back to your siblings, you know, one by one coming out there, your sister comes out there. Is it one of those things where having lived in the San Jose Valley, San Francisco area, there is something about it, right? Especially as you're coming from Michigan where it's green. It's pretty green out there as well. So you're kind of like moving from green to green, but the weather is dramatically better in the winter months and you have the beach. Do you think they came out because you led the way and they all followed from that, or did they all fall in love with the place and you just happened to be there?
No, I think I kind of led the way. They'll all say that. But they, I just made it possible to come visit. And, you know, my sister knew I was here, wasn't just moving out with nobody around, and had a good job offer. And that started. She's very influential in the family, as I may be. We'll have to, you can ask them. But and then I'm trying to think of who was next. I think Brendan was next because he got in the Stanford program. And then I got Brendan an internship out here in the summer with the place I work, Spectrophysics. Then I got my youngest brother, Matt, an internship at another company that he still works for. This is 25 years later. And then I think by the time we had like three or four here, then the other ones had a whole lot of people to come visit and see. And it just became natural for my other brothers and sisters to find work and move here because they...
Well, and I think what's great, though, is as you talk about it, I mean, there's clearly this sense of family for you and the strength of the relationship. You know, I always joke that when you have a big family like that, there's always the black sheep. And then I use my wife's family as the exception. And, you know, she's one of five and she has four brothers and they all disgustingly love each other and never fight. And the boys go on a ski trip every year with each other. And it's almost to nausea how well they get along. And I say that tongue in cheek. And it sounds like you're the same way with your family, is that all the siblings, you guys get along. I'm
sure. Yeah. I think there's been a few differences, but they're quite unusual and rare. And I take a big weekend, the boys' weekend in the summer with all my brothers, and we add brother-in-laws and we add friends, and that's usually 12 to 15 guys at my cabin up in the Sierras. And that's been a neat tradition for a number of years. And, take my boys on a ski trip.
That's awesome.
My sons. And, there's something about this, having these annual traditions of gatherings or trips. I've been doing that for years. I've noticed that with friends, and they just stick. You know, I'd take the boys to mountain biking in Moab, Utah for years, or the ski trip up in the Lake Tahoe region around Christmas.
So I'm not close to either of my brothers, right? For various psychological damaging reasons, probably, but I'm not close to any of my brothers. And I always wonder what it's like to be close to your siblings. And so, you do these ritualistic trips every year. Is it something you look forward to because you guys can be slightly different or unique or create your own experiences, and those experiences feed you for another 365 days a year? What is it about this that kind of keeps you going every year?
Well, I'd have to say that it's sort of a reflection of a good childhood and a good experiences growing up, that our parents did this, have these wonderful trips as families we had a cottage on the lake, and we would just go out there and live and be with each other. And my dad would drive 20 miles into work instead of one block to work, but it still worked. That just sort of established, and we did trips to around the area in winter and in the summer to Detroit, or some smaller trips to colleges for football games or something. It was a big family, so it's not that easy to move around, but we would have these traditions of going to Howard Johnson's or to staying at some place in Marshall, Michigan, or having these big family reunions every few years on my mother's side and my father's side. I have 56 first cousins, so we have, and that tradition continues now. It's more like for funerals and things for my aunts and uncles who are all passing away. But they still turn into these kind of family reunions. And there's something about this big Irish Catholic German mixture that seems to work. I mean, all my cousins are, I've lost track of some of them, but not all of them. Many of them I still see occasionally, or, there's just a few aunts and uncles left. Just the rare ones are going to turn 103 in June in Washington, D.C. So I've gone out to see her and my seven girl cousins who live there, and they're just a happy, great family together. So I don't know. It's just somehow it's in the DNA of the families.
Are either of your children married? I think you have two boys.
Two boys, and one is about to get married this coming July. So he's 27. He's in medical school. He's going to be in the airlines, but he switched completely to go into medicine. That's a long story. But he also joined the Navy. That's the Navy medical program, they call it, that covers your medical school and residency and all that stuff. So he's really on a big track now. He's been trying to figure it out for years, and so he's on his way. He lives in Indianapolis. Goes to school there, Marion University, it's called. Very cool. So he really has a mission now. It's pretty cool. And he's going to get married, and he's going to be in the Navy. So all these things are kind of aligning for him. And my youngest is just getting out of college this year as an engineer, mechanical engineer. So cool.
And where did he go?
He is at Purdue.
Right?
So they're both within an hour of each other.
And watch, they're going to leave the West Coast and all move to the Midwest, and eventually you and your wife will just move to the Midwest to be near them.
Well, that would be irony, wouldn't it?
So now, as a dad of two older kids, both through college, Like, how has your relationship changed with those, with your boys over time?
Well, that's
because as a dad of four, like, I'm going to have to go through this process, right?
Yeah. Again, I would fall back on the fact that, you know, if you have a good relationship with them, you know, try hard when they're younger. Expose them to a lot of cool activities. This is a fun thing about being a parent or being a father, I think, and see what sticks. You know, they're often more interested in hanging out with their friends or playing video games or doing wacky stuff. But you just say, well, we're going to go on this bike ride. We're going to go on this sailing trip. We're going to go on this ski trip. We're going to go on this, you know, on a trip to ride mountain bikes here, and we're going to take this trip to Europe, and then we're going to do this trip to Washington, D.C., or to New York, or to Chicago, to Africa. We just, you know, we have this cabin, we're going up there, and we're learning how to sail. We're just hiking, we're doing all this stuff. There's a fair amount of complaining, but the coolest thing is that they, especially in the older one's case, he's doing all this stuff now because he likes to. You know, he loves to sail. He's a hiker. he's been a biker for years. This all this stuff comes around. You just set a good example and you expose them to stuff. I mean, you don't like completely force them, although you just say, well, we're doing this afternoon and let's go, or just for a trip. And they learn by exposure and by good example. You see the parents doing stuff together, and you know, I think you just, you know, you set the next generation up to have a good life and be active and participatory, and you know, we've done some volunteer work together a little bit, and I support about 50 causes, and they see that, and we're pretty liberal here. So they seem to have caught that bug.
How did you, you know, so just my audience knows, I mean, obviously you're a founding partner of IDEO, as I mentioned earlier, which is a global company with, I think it's 9 offices around the world. Yeah, I'm not even sure how many employees you have.
I think it's about 700.
Wow. Right. And you've got this huge network of other operations you guys do around IDEO, like, what was it? I was looking at this today. I think I lost it. But you've got like the IDEO U and the IDEO something. Like you've got a whole bunch of different.
Well, there's Open IDEO. We have a ton of this Open IDEO. IDEO U.
IDEO Futures. IDEO.org. IDEO Collab. Yeah. And then IDEO.org.
Any one point, there's a bunch of things that aren't published. There's 10 or 15 different experiments going on. The way we look at it, and this is the way to survive, is you sort of have to disrupt yourself before others do. And we've spread this whole gospel of design thinking around for years, and now people really get it. There's dozens of firms that compete with us on every level. Many of them are former IDEO people. And there's now a couple dozen schools that really teach design thinking, and there's dozens or hundreds of big companies that have their own design departments and design thinking philosophies that didn't 10 years ago. So the competition is strong and fierce out there. So we're constantly trying to reinvent the whole creative space and have all these experiments going on and allow people, smart, motivated people, to invent their own parts of the business and see what works and what sticks. And a lot of it's doing quite well, and it's very interesting. And, you know, I mean, it's a little too early to tell in a lot of cases, but I think it's exciting and interesting to see. And like I said, it really allows for smart, motivated people to invent parts of the business, stay here instead of going out and starting their own business. They get to invent part of IDEO's business.
But that leads me to my question, though, right? So you've got this big, successful business with 700 employees. You still work, and I'm sure you've split your time a bit differently now than what you did 20 years ago. So how did you manage that and have a family and be a present dad, setting examples and, you know, creating the trail for your kids to blaze?
Well, yeah, I think you just have to do a lot of juggling, I would give a lot of credit to the fact that my wife and I decided right early on to have, you know, spend a fair amount of what we made on nannies and services of all sorts to kind of balance out our lives. I mean, we've had a marvelous couple of nannies, one in particular for 20 years, and she was from El Salvador, Angela, and like a third parent in the home, just came, you know, full time every week. And if we're not there, we're traveling or we're working late, she's there and making dinner and driving people around. Or then when we could, we would. And it somehow all worked out fairly well. But if we were trying to do everything, complete, you know, I mean, our friends joked that even our staff had staff. you know, we'd spend the equivalent of one salary, I think, one of our two salaries on managing to this life. Yeah. But I don't see any other way we could have done it. And it worked out, I think, fairly well. You have to ask our kids. I think there's a little bit of guilt to that. We didn't spend as much time with them as we could, but I think we did. I'd give ourselves a reasonably good grade for just making it all work and being part of their classes, being on class trips, doing all these trips with them, and we try to be home for dinner most nights. And I made dinner a lot, or Angela did, and so we had family dinners was pretty regularly. I mean, 4 out of 5 nights, or 3 out of 5 nights probably, and then weekend dinners and soup nights on Sunday nights. And
how have you done it? Because you guys working,
you know,
I mean, that sometimes could be a pretty big recipe for divorce, because you both are career oriented, working lots of hours. You're creating a large organization. She's running a department or whatever. And how did you guys make your marriage work over the time?
Yeah, she's running a whole company herself. She's running a whole company. Well, you know, I think there were some stresses at times.
I hear that in your voice.
I have to be the first to admit that. Yeah. We just sometimes, like, we're both on crazy deadlines. We both have to go on trips. But again, it's having Angela kind of made it all possible with these things. But I think we both... I think I was able, because the company grew fast enough so that there's a lot of leaders around, that I didn't actually have to. In the 80s, I think I would work 14 weekends in a row or something like that. But once I had children, I think I was, and the whole company started having children in the late 80s and the 90s, things got, you know, more manageable. It wasn't completely burnout kind of schedules. We had to do that so we could survive. And we could attract people that had families that didn't want to, like, completely, you know, give them up, of course. And so the scale of our business has allowed teams and a mixture of people with and without families to kind of coexist somewhat reasonably. And, yeah, we're still a very deadline-faced culture, but we can – our reputation has allowed us to, you know, get good clients and keep them and – it's worked relatively well. There's always a threat of imminent, like, what are we going to be doing in 3 to 6 months kind of thing, and consulting, because you're never quite sure. But
that doesn't really answer my question about you and your wife.
It worked out reasonably well.
Yeah, so, like, was there a time in your marriage where...
Oh, okay.
I mean, was there a time in your marriage where stress was peaked and you guys had to have, like, a heart-to-heart of, like, balance? Because what's interesting to me is that you both grew up in these big families, which usually means a mom stays home, which typically manifests itself in the next generation. So, like, my wife, she works part-time, but she's half home, half working, right? So, but for her, like, she likes being with the kids. Like, that's how she was raised.
Well, I think it's a good question, and we certainly had a handful of crises when we were just too stressed to be good parents or good spouses at times, and trips would coincide. But luckily, I said the real secret, I think, was having a nanny. And at one point, we had two nannies. And then we had people that did our laundry, that do our yard, that come and fix things in the house, deliver stuff. I had groceries delivered. We just kept relentlessly trying to figure out systems to help us, like, not have to have tons of work to do when we got home. We could be there. And that kind of worked. I'd have to say it worked somewhat well. That was more or less my effort. I'm the one who had. And so I concentrated on that, creating these home systems. And Peggy helped a lot, too, especially around the nanny thing. But then we could really, we had people we could call on. And my brothers and sisters are around, and they would spell us once in a while or help out. We had a few come to Jesus meetings on how are we going to do this in the next few weeks or month? Or, this is not good. We haven't all been home for a while. But it's somehow, the toughest time were in the 90s when the kids were young, really young. But again, we just try to get a lot of help. I think some priest gave us this advice when we were like having this pre-Cana thing, getting ready to get married, and he said, well, we're both working, huh? We're both doing this. We're both kind of have your own companies or something like that. And he said, you should take some of your resources and make sure you get a lot of help. Because you're going to need it, and it's not worth, burning out if you're not going to, we're not, one of you isn't going to be home. You're going to have to get a lot of help. And I think we managed to make that work for us.
So what happened to Angela? Did she go back or?
Right. She talked to her yesterday. No, she's one other cool thing. She's from El Salvador. In fact, the three nannies we had were four nannies we had. Angela was there for 20 years. The other nannies were for a few years each, but three out of the four were from El Salvador. So, but Angela, we just told her to speak Spanish in the home, and as a consequence, our boys, especially the younger one, can really, speak somewhat and understand it reasonably well. So that's a cool side benefit. But Angela's, once Taylor, the youngest one, went off to college, she went and started working for other families that had young children because he loved young children so well. She didn't have any of her own, and so these are how she has, has a family in a certain way.
So, all right, just a couple more questions, and I want to do what's called my fast. Sorry, go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, she works just a few blocks from here now, and we hear from her, especially when the younger one comes home and looks her up and has her over. So
I just want to ask just two more questions, and then I want to do what's called my Fast Five, and then I want to talk about IDEO as a brand and its strengths and weaknesses and kind of the goals that you have. So I'm just curious, you opened IDEO in 1979, at least that's what I have according to my notes.
78, I think. And I came in 1980, so Dave Kelly really started the company and had his friends come join him, and I was one of their early friends and the first, half dozen people. So that's the actual origin story. Another fellow, Dean Hubby and David, started the company. It was called Hubby Kelly Design in the late 70s, early 80s, and then I came with a handful of others, and we started on the path of growing.
So when you started the company, I mean, did you guys know where it was going to go? Did you have that vision?
No, not at all. Really. We just wanted to, we enjoyed working with each other. It was kind of a working family, in a certain way. We had met each other all at Stanford in this product design, and things related to it, group of, it was engineering and design and art and a bit of business. And that kind of inspired us to, we could do this and maybe we could get paid for what we're paying tuition for. and that was sort of the, and I have this letter from David, and he sent over, I want to start a company with all my friends, and I'd like you to be one of the people that join, and you'll have it somewhere. But that was the work with your friends and have a good experience using designing things that were useful or valuable or interesting. And that was the whole thing. I don't think we ever thought much more than a year or two in advance. We thought, well, let's just try this for a few years. And a lot of us like teaching. We thought, well, maybe we could always just go teach, you know, if this doesn't work out, or I guess we could work for someone else. But we just, it wasn't ever, there were no grand plans. In fact, there's articles written about where Dave said, well, we'll never be above 20. And then he said, we'll never be above 40. And then we'll never be above 100 people. And then he said, I'm not going to quote, I'm not going to say anything about that again because I'm always wrong. So, yeah, well, it's pretty organic growth, and there's been some, you know, but the whole idea has never been just to grow. It's just to find great people to work with and find great work to do and allow people to have a good, interesting career in life. Mm-hmm. And things have grown. We just keep experimenting in every which way with locations. The only reason we have locations is almost exclusively because somebody wanted to go home there. They were from the London thing is because of our artifact of a combination of things. But Munich and Asia and Chicago and Boston and some degree New York, people wanted to go home there, and they were from there, and they started, well, we don't want to lose them. Why don't you try something? So we've tried six or seven locations not work over time for lots of different various reasons, but those that we have stuck because, well, they've been in the right place, the right time, the right people, the right chemistry, the right business environment. So anyway, they're all experiments, and I think that's the mark of our company. If you keep trying things and we're trying about a dozen or two dozen things right now that it's we're just trying to find out what is needed and excel at it. So that's a neat part of the DNA here.
Well, and it's awesome because I think what's interesting about what I hear from you when you describe IDEO and expansion and growth is curiosity has just always been kind of part of the core culture of the organization.
Well, yes, and it has to be in a design and innovation company. Maybe that's people come to you, and they want to hire you because of that, some of that ability and that drive, because you're trying to help them reinvent parts of their business, and you really need that kind of that ethic, that drive, that ability to be endlessly curious.
So awesome. So what I want to do is I'm going to do my fast five real quick. Five random questions. Answer them as slow, as fast as you like. And then I really want to talk about IDEO and probably more specifically about design thinking, because I think it's a fascinating concept. And I did a class. I did a session on it. I won't even say a class. I did a session on it. And I just think it's a phenomenal way to get people engaged. So Dennis, are you ready to play my fast five?
Yes, definitely.
I need more enthusiasm, Dennis. I need a yes.
Yes.
There we go.
I'm on it.
There we go. All right. So question one, what was your first job ever?
My first job ever, I guess I would count that as being a paper boy for the Midland Daily News. And that was in high school. Or, you know, late grade school or early high school. And, I think I had 50 subscribers, and up and down the street I lived on, Main Street in Midland, Michigan. Sounds like almost a cliche. and rain or sun or snow, there's plenty of snow up in the winter, so I would typically ride my bike even in the snow if I could. Which was an interesting experiment.
What did you learn?
Get to these people. I learned just kind of endurance and the kind of fact that you had to just stick to it. You just couldn't like skip a day and have all those paper sitting on a curb, not going anywhere. And you learn sort of persistence, because a lot of people were hard to get when you had to collect from them, which is once a month. And that was hard, because a lot of people would, I think some people would sort of purposely see me coming and sort of like not answer the door sometimes. Or too bad for a 14-year-old kid or something like that. And then, you know, papers would get messed up in the delivery process, and you had to go replace them. People would call in, and their paper was wet, or, you know, that did never came or something. Somebody must have lifted it, because that was pretty reliable. And then you had to go take your collection down to the paper, and they'd pay you out of that, you know. So,
Christmas is kind of
good, because everyone gave you. Sure.
So when you're collecting at 14, how do you muster the strength to argue, I guess, essentially with an adult to get the money?
Well, I don't know. It wasn't all that hard. Mostly, we're just trying to find them. They didn't really try to shaft a 14-year-old. They kind of got it. It wasn't that much money. You know, so I didn't have that much trouble. It was just sort of finding them home and having to go back and back. And you know, on my route, then I would start to know who wasn't paying, and I'd have to stop and try to find them. And yeah, I don't even remember it very well now. It's like 50 years ago.
Sure, so. Sure. All right, question two. This will be an interesting answer to get someone who is wise from their experience in life. But what animal best defines your management style?
Animal? Oh, my Lord. That's a first. I guess, you know, a sort of a, you know, a border collie, maybe.
So a dog?
Just because we've had a lot of good dogs, and we have these Vizslas and other dogs too. And the border collie or the Vizsla, they're just relentless. They can run and run, and they're attentive, and they're smart, and they learn fast. Especially these border collies. My son has one, and I don't know. They're loyal, and they just stay with it, and they love running. And they have endurance, and so those are qualities that I like to have or try to cultivate. So maybe that's it.
All right, excellent. Question three: what advice would you give your 25-year-old self?
Buy more Apple stock for Outbike. you know, I've had a great life. I guess I'd just say. If I had a do-over, I might actually consider trying a startup again at some point during this process. Although I've been very happy doing what I'm doing, which is working for startups in many cases and helping other startups, mm-hmm. being on board and stuff. So I don't know. I guess I did all the teaching I like to do, and the work has been... It's been great.
Would you be more patient? Would you be more aggressive? Would you be kinder? Would you be, you know, was there something about yourself that...
No, I like all those things about me now. I mean, I think I would try to counsel myself to worry less about outcomes. I'm kind of a worrier at times. I've learned really over time how to manage that quite well with exercise, with meditation, with getting the right amount of sleep, with eating well, with not drinking too much, and keeping the caffeine low or off, especially in these. And, you know, really sweat the deadlines and sweat the, you know, any negative feedback you get from clients or something. And, you know, deadlines really pile up, so you get kind of worried and nervous and anxious about stuff. So that would be, I'd really give myself this whole list of things I've learned how to do that help keep these things at bay and enjoy life more. So I think I've really learned that over many years, 40 years now.
So tell me about the meditation. When did that start?
That started probably about 10 years ago, maybe a little more, maybe 15. Probably 15 years ago. It was just upset and distraught over tons of stuff that didn't seem to be going well. Sometimes you can't, every single client or every single experience or every single project or experiment just can't all be A pluses. So it was definitely, let's see, 2017, 2000, when the bubble burst in, and I had a business and had a bunch of clients. And I had a side business or part of the IDEO, but this products business for the handheld computers, and it was just all was going well, and then it was just like blew up when everything went totally bad. And we had one of the only times in the whole company's history we had to lay people off in 40 years. We never had to do that. I mean, that was just so stressful. And then a bunch of all this cool work and sales that were going on for the handheld accessories market and little cameras and all that. It just like collapsed, because everything collapsed in the high tech field. It was just super stressful. And so I took a couple of these mindfulness and meditation classes at a local health care center and really started to get into a habit of doing this regularly, daily. And I went to some insight meditation centers, and I have about 30 books that I've read that's all in this area that have been very, it's really calmed me down and given me people notice it. It's kind of they say, you know, it's kind of a nice zen-like approach to everything. So I think that's helped me really approach things with kindness and compassion and kind of with thoughtfulness and not let things really flip me out. Like they did when I was more in my 20s and 30s and even 40s.
I would imagine, and part of that has allowed you to deal with what would usually stress you out in a calm manner, which allows you to think a lot more clearly about the choice that you need to make in a practical standpoint, you know, being pragmatic.
I think that's a good assessment of it. You know, you can go in this sort of death spiral if things start going wrong, and they always do at some point, to some degree. But you can sort of keep yourself at level flight, to keep the analogy of flying or, you know, spiraling. And you can keep yourself from going too low or staying kind of somewhat normal by sort of this whole practice of stepping back a little bit. Okay, I can see myself getting stressed out. What's the worst that can happen? And then kind of talking yourself through and writing a bunch of this stuff down, and especially talking to my spouse or my brother or my other good friends about, this seems wacky. This is not good. Or here's what's going on. And they often can give you some perspective that, well, it's not that bad. Or you might think about this, or, you know, you get sort of, you lose some self-confidence, and you sort of forget about where you are, where you've been, and kind of thing.
Do you lose confidence now sometimes?
Well, yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think it's slightly, just all this, these practices I've learned over many years that are somewhat related to meditation, but you keep up good physical exercise. Even if you have terrible deadlines, you try not to lose sleep, or you try to get a reasonable amount of sleep. And then the alcohol, the caffeine, even things. Don't listen to constant rock music. Move that to something like jazz. All these things, connect with all your friends and be thankful and have gratitude. Kind of make a list of what you're thankful for. These little things, was this book, 365 Thank Yous I Love, which is send somebody a thank you note every day. I did that for the better part of a year, but I still do that to some degree. And I don't know, all these things add up so that you kind of stay in the present and don't flip out so much. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, question four. When you pass away, when you are no longer in this world, what do you want people at your funeral to be talking about when it comes to you?
Well, you know, he was just good at a lot of things. A good spouse, a good father, a good son, a good brother, a good designer, a good teacher. And kind and compassionate and funny and smart and kind of left a legacy with a bunch of people that loved and admired him and accomplished some neat things from in his work from an innovation standpoint
If I was to summarize that for you, is that you really just want to be able to leave a legacy not only of what you've done from a professional standpoint, but who you are as a person.
Yeah.
All right. Final question of Fast Five, which you clearly can see the name does not fit. What is something that, beyond your family, what is something that you that makes you smile, that makes you laugh?
Well, I mean, good kind of political humor, like The Daily Show or The Colbert Report, or those things just drive me, or Saturday Night Live, or, you know, those things are hilarious.
Well, thanks for doing Fast Five. What I want to do is just quickly, you know, I know your time is very valuable, and as my audience probably doesn't realize, this is the second time I've talked to you to try to get this all down, is I want to quickly just talk to you about IDEO and, you know, where's the future? I mean, what most of my audience probably doesn't realize is that IDEO is at the forefront of product design and development and innovation globally. And, you know, it all starts with you and your partner, Mr. David Kelly. Back in 1979, I think you joined in 1980, if I'm recalling from our conversation. And, you know, you guys have taken this company to places that I don't know if you expected it to go, but where is it going? Like, where do you see the industry going? Where do you see the company going? And I'll let you kind of just run with that.
Well, I mean, yeah, I happen to be the one of the, well, other, David and I are the last initial people still here. David really started the company, and there are about six, eight of us at the beginning of the company here, and it's somewhat complicated because we merged with other firms in the 90s. But anyway, right now there's a very healthy partnership of about 35 partners who really manage and, the company, of which I'm one. And, you know, the thing has gone from a small little, you know, design practice, product design practice, to a large design, innovation and design company that's nine offices around the world. And our business, you know, product design still is a nice, interesting segment of what we do, but it's definitely minority. Maybe a quarter of what we do, when depending on how you measure it. But this design thinking process seems to be able to be very useful across the board, and just being innovative in almost any industry, in things that are not products, like services, like experiences, like strategies. And so, gosh, we're working for almost everybody you can imagine, from automotive related to food and beverage, to financial services, design for education, to toys, strategic design for change kinds of initiatives. With almost every industry, we're C-suite people want to change their whole strategy and their whole business. So we're doing quite a bit of that these days, and government work. And it's just easier to say we don't work for tobacco companies and companies that produce firearms or something like that. You know? everything else is it's being worked on in spare game and spread all around the U.S. and or Europe and Asia now. So it's pretty neat.
So what would you say your core competency is then if it's not design?
Well, it is design. This process of design thinking is applied to helping people be innovative, helping them be disruptive in whatever industry they're in. If they want to start a whole new school system, or they want to do some dramatically different financial services, or they want to rethink mobility because cars are quickly becoming computers and not cars. You know, they've got something else. You know, the future of health and medicine from a medical standpoint is very low invasive or no invasive kinds of procedures and telehealth and artificial intelligence to help health teams and connected health around, you know, helping people have chronic conditions in a much better way than just go to the doctor once a year. So it's just a great deal of variety that has to do with design thinking at its center, the whole process of understanding people's needs and then designing solutions for it. So that's how the business is going.
But do you remember a time when the business kind of started transitioning in terms of percentage of where your revenues came from, when it shifted from more product design to more consulting around design thinking?
Well, that's been a very gradual process over the last, say, 25 years, actually. As we noticed, there hasn't been a real big inflection point there. It's just been a very gradual, it just added to what we seem to be asked to do more and more. There's a lot of people that want to know how this education how this focus can be educated. I mean, how we can educate people in this process. So that's becoming a bigger part of our offer. There's something we call IDOU, which is online learning of this process. Look it up. It's four or five courses are now online. And so that's becoming a part of the business. There's IDEO.org, which is using the process to help people with poverty around the world, especially in Asia, Africa, India, now even Americas. There's other things. We're trying to work in new ways with companies with the labs format, which means that they may send six or eight people, and we put six or eight people on a project, and you work for a year together, and those people from the client's company really learn the process intimately because they're in the team working every day in the ideal location. So that's a new way of working recently that seems to be taking off.
That's awesome.
So there's a lot of – you're constantly experimenting with ways to work and do useful things for our clients.
It almost sounds like what IDEO is doing now is really this unique place in the industry where you're educating everyone how to do this, how to do design thinking. Are you ever concerned, and probably not, are you ever concerned that this is kind of just a fad?
Well, it's not a fad. I mean, it's being, but the thing is that because we've educated everybody and we're doing it constantly in all the universities near our 9 or 10 offices around the world, and we're writing books about it, like 5 books, 6 books. We're doing online learning and constant workshops, and everybody's starting to really get it, know it. So we're working hard to figure out what's needed now. I mean, that's no secret. If you just constantly spread out your process and teach it and promote it and help everyone learn it, well, then you got to, it's not so special anymore. So I think there's some of that going on, but that just goads you or prods you into better, more innovative thinking. That's kind of an endless cycle that you sign up for, but it's a good one.
And so when you think about IDEO, you know, I don't know when you planned, like, do you have a time when you're going to step away from IDEO?
Well, I don't have I'm not making any announcements now. I mean,
sure. I'm not going to break
here
that
for another 37 years. So, you know, but I'm actually enjoying myself, and you know, I'll do this for some period of time now, you know, it could be 5 years. I don't know, you know, so it's, you know, there's other fun things to do with my wife, and travel and teach and so on. But right now I'm enjoying myself and it seems to be working. So, I'll keep you informed.
And if you could, and just a couple more questions, if you could get your partners all on the same page, could you get them, if you could get all your partners to agree on a unified vision, which I am sure is ridiculously difficult to do, like, where do you see you guys going in the next 10 or 15 years as a business? Like, where do you see the industry taking you? Because I always thought of you guys as a more of a product design firm, but as you described it, it's actually much more of a consulting firm, at least the way I understand it. But then I think about back to the design, where it's kind of an exciting time if you're a design firm, because you can start looking at how technology and products are starting to basically meld together in this convergence of everything in technology and wearables and embedded wearables and clothing and just all that stuff. So, like, where do you guys think you're going?
Well, I mean, it's just that's another hour or two of saying stuff, but you just captured it fairly nicely.
Can I get paid for that?
We're just spreading this. Yeah, sure. Send it. You know, we're spread the footprint of the company spreading out significantly from being product designers in a very narrow sense to being designers of people's lives and experiences, and there's a big educational component, and there's just trying to help people stay healthy, be happy, be fulfilled. I mean, these are more fundamental. Really, we're working in mental health areas, or palliative care, or end of life, or design for birth, or children, you know, tweens, education, or, you know, the nutrition for children or for elders. We're just applying this. We're able to apply this design thinking process in a wider and wider way, helping companies rethink their missions and things. So it's exciting time to be in this business.
Awesome. Let me ask you one final question before you run. You know, how do you, Dennis, how do you define happiness?
Making a difference with people that need what I do. And I support a whole bunch of charities, and some more active than others. And so that feels like I can give back in many ways, financially and somewhat physically. I'm on about 7 or 8 boards of nonprofits and stuff. So, yeah,
awesome.
It's a rich,
awesome,
actually fulfilling life, you know. So,
well, Dennis, thank you so much for your time and energy to talk to me twice in 2 weeks. So I wish you all the best, and thanks for your time.
Very good. Love speaking with you, and I hope we can meet in person before too long.
Same. Thank you, Dennis.
I'll see you soon.
Take care.
Bye, y'all. Bye, thanks.